Kuti Vaishnava Vrindakitan, Iskam Bibiti Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Kitan, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Kitan, Iskam Guru Vrindakitan, Prem Sukho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Vaita Gadadhar Shivasi Gaura Bhakta Vrindakitan, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaura Gopinashyam Kun Radha Kun Giri Gopi Dhani Kitan, Shri Vrindavan Dhamma Kitan, Shri Mayapur Dhamma Kitan, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Kitan, Tulsi Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Ganga Jamuna Maya Ki Jai, Sankirtan Jagna Ki Jai, Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, The Transcendental Lordships, Shri Shri Panchatattva Ki Jai, Shri Shri Radhamadava Ki Jai, Shri Prahlad Nrisimhadeva Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Gaura Premanande, Samaveda Bhaktavinda Ki Jai, All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Guru. So there are four verses that I've been asked to cover today. So, first, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So I guess what I'll do is I'll first read the slokas. This is the last sloka. And I'll do the preceding three slokas on my own, and then we'll get to this point. It'll take a while because there's one quite a long purport. So this is text 24. Nanda Chalankananda Cha Charito Bayatapura Tutapad Pada Boja Rajastiva Pavane. They also saw the two rivers named Nanda and Alakananda. These two rivers are sanctified by the dust of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda. Text 25. Yayo sura striya shatar avaruya swadishnyata kridantati pumsha sinchanjo vigaya ratikarshita. My dear Shata, Vidura, the celestial damsels come down to those rivers in their airplanes with their husbands. And after sexual enjoyment, they enter the water and enjoy sprinkling their husbands with water. Purport. It is understood that even the damsels of the heavenly planets are polluted by thoughts of sex enjoyment. And therefore they come in airplanes to bathe in the rivers Nanda and Alakananda. It is significant that these rivers, Nanda and Alakananda, are sanctified by the dust of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, just as the Ganges is sacred because its water emanates from the toes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, so whenever water or anything is in touch with devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it is purified and spiritualized. The rules and regulations of devotional service are based on this principle. Anything in touch with the lotus feet of the Lord is immediately freed from all material contamination. The damsels of the heavenly planets, polluted by thoughts of sex life, come down to bathe in the sanctified rivers and enjoy sprinkling water on their husbands. Two words are very significant in this connection. Ratikarshita means that the damsels become morose after sex enjoyment. Although they accept sex enjoyment as a bodily demand, afterwards they are not happy. Another significant point is that Lord Govinda, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is described here as Tirthapad. Tirtha means sanctified place, and pad means the lotus feet of the Lord. People go to a sanctified place to free themselves from all sinful reactions. In other words, those who are devoted to the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, automatically become sanctified. The Lord's lotus feet are called Tirthapad because under their protection, there are hundreds and thousands of saintly persons who sanctify the sacred places of pilgrimage. Srila Narottam Das Thakur, the great Acharya of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, advises us not to travel to different places of pilgrimage. Undoubtedly, it is troublesome to go from one place to another, but one who is intelligent can take shelter of the lotus feet of Govinda and thereby be automatically sanctified as a result of his pilgrimage. Anyone who is fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Govinda is called Tirthapad. He does not need to travel on various pilgrimages, for he can enjoy all the benefits of such travel simply by engaging in the service of the lotus feet of the Lord. Such a devotee, such a pure devotee, who has implicit faith in the lotus feet of the Lord, can create sacred places in any part of the world where he decides to remain. Tirthi Kirvanti Tirthani. The places are sanctified due to the presence of pure devotees. Any place automatically becomes a place of pilgrimage if either the Lord or his pure devotee remains or resides there. In other words, such a pure devotee who is engaged 100% in the service of the Lord can remain anywhere in the universe, and that part of the universe immediately becomes a sacred place where he can peacefully render service to the Lord as the Lord desires. Okay, so then 26. Yostachnana viprasta navakunkum pinjaram vitrichopi pibantyamba payantyoto gajagaji. After the damsels of the heavenly planets bathe in the water, it becomes yellowish and fragrant due to the kumkum from their bodies. Thus the elephants come to bathe there with their wives, the she-elephants, and they also drink the water, although they are not thirsty. Okay, the shloka on the board, 27. Tadahima Maharatna Viman Shata Shankulam Justam Punyajana Stribi Punyajana Stribi Yata Kam Satadit Danam Tarahima Maharatna Viman Shata Sankulam Justam Punya Janastrir Bir Yatakam Satadidanam Tarahima Maharatna Vimam Shatta Sankulam Chustam Punya Janastri Bir Yatakam Satadid Ganam. Please chant. Brahima, of pearls and gold, Maharatna, valuable jewels, Viman, of airplanes, Shata, with hundreds, Shankulam, crowded, Justam, occupied, enjoyed, Punyajana Stribir, by wives of the Yakshas, Pita, as, come, the sky, Satadiganam, with the lightning in the clouds. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The airplanes of the heavenly denizens are bedecked with pearls, gold, and many valuable jewels. The heavenly denizens are compared to clouds in the sky, decorated with occasional flashes of electric lightning. Purport. The airplanes described in this verse are different from the airplanes of which we have experience. In the Srimad Bhagavatam and all the Vedic literatures, there are many descriptions of Viman, which means airplanes. On different planets, there are different kinds of airplanes. On this gross planet Earth, there are airplanes run by machine. But on other planets, the airplanes are run not by machine, but by mantric hymns. They are also used especially for enjoyment by the denizens of the heavenly planets, so that they can go from one planet to another. On other planets, which are called siddhalokas, the denizens can travel from one planet to another without airplanes. The beautiful airplanes from the heavenly planets are compared here to the sky because they fly in the sky. The passengers are compared to the clouds. The beautiful damsels, the wives of the heaven of the denizens of the heavenly planets, are compared to lightning. In summation, the airplanes with their passengers, which came from higher planets to Kailash, were very pleasant to look at. Omagana Timarandasha Gananjana Shirakaya Chakshur Umlitam Gena Tajmai Shri Gurave Namaha. It's been a long time since we covered the purport for the translation, or covered the translation of purport for the 25th text. So hopefully your memories are pretty sharp. But this, what I'm going to primarily speak on, because the purport's loaded. And so the translation for text 25 is, my dear Shata, the Dura, the celestial damsels come down to those rivers in their airplanes with their husbands, and after sexual enjoyment, they enter the water and enjoy sprinkling their husbands with water. One thing that stands out in this purport, second paragraph, the damsels of the heavenly planets, polluted by thoughts of sex life, come down to bathe in the sanctified rivers and enjoy sprinkling water on their husbands. Two words are very significant in this connection. Rati Karshita means that the damsels become morose after sex enjoyment. Although they accept sex enjoyment as a bodily demand, afterwards they are not happy. Prabhupada would often quote a Hindi proverb, which I don't know, but the key words in it are Dilika Ladu. Anybody know what Dilika Ladu stands for? Can someone convey that to me? Pass the baton of the sound vibration, because I couldn't quite hear it.
It means that one who eats ladu
But it's a special, it's the Delhi Laddu. Dilika means Delhi, right? So, are you from Delhi? Oh. So, Prabhupada uses it in a context that one, this is a very special Laddu. One who has never tasted it laments, and then one who has not tasted it also laments. So he uses this in reference to marriage and sex, the Dilika Laddu. Okay, so if you've never been married, then you lament that you've not had this opportunity. If you're married, then all you do is lament that you got married. Okay? This is Dilika Laddu. Prabhupada calls it the Laddu of Lamentation. Okay, so it's quite interesting because this sex is considered by the materialist to be the highest platform of happiness. And here we are, some of the most elevated material personalities, the damsels of the heavenly planets, they come to a very beautiful location and they're frolicking in sanctified waters of the Nanda and Alakananda rivers, and then they enjoy sexually with their demigod husbands. And they're not happy. Now that says, that's a pretty strong statement. Palladana Maharaj, in his prayers to pacify Lord Nrisimhadev, he said something which is also quite interesting for those that are convinced that sex life is the highest pleasure in this material world. He says, Yan maitunadi griyamedi sukham hitucham kandu yanena kareyor iva dukha dukham chapyanti neha kripa dukha baha chapyanti neha kripa dukha bahu dukha bhaja dan kanduti van manasitam vishaheta dira. So he says that sex life is compared to the rubbing of two hands together to relieve an itch. And this is, and he says that this is considered by the Grihamedis, so-called Grihasthas who have no spiritual knowledge, to be the greatest platform of happiness, although actually it's a source of distress. And then he says, those who are dira, however, who have controlled their senses, understood the purpose of life, they tolerate this suffering, and therefore they're not subjected, or they tolerate this itching sensation, and therefore they're not subjected to the suffering of the fools and rascals. Bahu Dukha Bhaja, this many-faced, multifaceted suffering that comes from the Dilika Laddu, from indulging in sex life. So, before I entered university in America, when you, the summer before you go into university, they give you a required reading list to prepare you for what's up ahead. And so one book that I was required to read was called The Hidden Persuaders. I still remember this. It was so, it stood out so much in my mind. It was written by a person called Vance Packard. He was a psychologist. And The Hidden Persuaders was all about what the advertising industry uses to manipulate people to buy products that they don't need, they don't want, but somehow to get them to think that they need this and they want this, and without it their life won't be happy. So interestingly enough, and this is actually Madison Avenue, which is kind of the holy dam of the advertising industry, hires very, very competent psychologists at a very high price to insidiously manipulate the mind of the general public. Their main technique is to somehow or other get the living entities that see the advertisement to think that they're going to enjoy sex life better if they do this. And there's some things that they were using. This, I'm an old man, so when I read this book, it was a long time ago. Let's say it would have been the summer of 67. And some of the techniques that the advertising industry were utilizing in that time have since been outlawed. But they used to, they relied quite heavily upon subliminal influence, where they would, like for instance, to get people to buy a particular brand of vodka, which is a Russian alcoholic beverage, they would conceal within the ice cubes of the vodka bottle a picture of a naked woman. And they would do different things, that they would put slides, or, you know, in movie theaters, they would put some, you know, they'd have frames of the film, there'd be some kind of a sexual prompting, which would induce people to go to the snack bar and buy popcorn and Coca-Cola. But we noticed that just on the gross level, most advertising is connected with a beautiful woman. And if you buy this particular kind of cigarette and smoke it, that woman is yours. You know, there's that kind of inference that's kind of pervasive within the advertising industry. So we can understand that this desire for sexual enjoyment is a very powerful one within the material world. Prabhupada describes it as maitunya agar. Sometimes we see, you know, we go to Calcutta and we see a handsome young business executive walking down, trying to think of some of the names of the streets there. Chanti Ranga, Ho Chi Minh Saranga, Sarani, okay, that's named after Ho Chi Minh, the hero of the Vietnam War. And, you know, he's very proud to have, you know, this beautiful damsel accompanying him. So it's like the whole emphasis of material life is to get this enjoyment. And then what comes of it, you know, and why would Prabhupada say maitunya agar? Agar means shackles. It's like, you know, handcuffs. It's like punishment. And you know, so actually we could view it in a different way from the vision of a Vaishnava, that this person, this up-and-coming business executive with this beautiful woman, that somehow they've been wooed by his prowess in the business arena to be his consort. He's actually being punished by this arrangement. He thinks, wow, this is great. I got this. I finally got the girl of my dreams. But actually, this is a great punishment. He's being incarcerated and entangled in life after life of suffering. See if I can remember it. There's Shabdev to his sons, he said, Nunam pramata kurute vikarma yadindriya pritaya apanoti na saru yat manye yata atmano asana piklesheta asadeha. So persons that are convinced that material happiness is the pinnacle of life. They're mad after material sense gratification. They don't know that they've already been awarded this body for sense gratification, and actually by engaging in sense gratification, they get repeated birth and death. They suffer life after life after life after life. So therefore, Rishabhdev's instructs his sons, the intelligent person doesn't engage in sense gratification because he can understand that this is what actually causes his suffering. Earlier in the seventh canto, Prahlad Maharaj describes to his classmates that as soon as one starts endeavoring for sense gratification, as soon as that starts, his suffering begins. So, I mean, this may sound like, wow, what a pessimistic view of life that Hare Krishna devotees have. Usually at Sunday feast programs in the West, you don't speak like this because, you know, no one will come again. They'll just say, oh my God. Because there it's just so all-pervasive, you know, sexuality, you know, and that everyone is just hell-bent on enjoying this way to the maximum. In India, such a class is a little more acceptable because this is the land of tapa. People are, you know, here, someone, it's much more realistic to think of a lifetime of brahmacharya because there's no exposure right from the very beginning. There's still some parda, you know, some separation, gender separation. And, you know, it's a respectable position. So, it takes intelligence, you know, as Rishabhdev says, the intelligent person doesn't indulge in these things because he understands this actually creates more and more suffering, more and more births and deaths. And, but how do we actually control that? Radhika Nagar Prabhu is facilitating the Bhakti Vaibhava course, and he was telling me of a really wonderful presentation that was made by one of the Indian brahmacharis in the Mayapur Institute courses. There's an aspect that deals with personal application. So here's a brahmachari who's been brahmachari many, many years, and he had so much trust amongst the students that he was able to express the struggles that he had with sex life, the sex desire. And so it's something that, as long, Prabhupada says, as long as we have this material body, this is a challenge. So how actually can we deal with it so that we don't end up unhappy like these heavenly damsels? How can we actually transcend this powerful force? I'll tell you another little anecdote. This is from the very early days of the movement. Brahmananda Prabhu, when he first became attracted to Srila Prabhupada, he was still a university student. I think he was at NYU, if I'm not mistaken. It's a very good university, New York University, NYU. And he had an English literature professor that was always trying to analyze whatever was being studied in this English literature course from the standpoint of Freudian psychology. Now, of course, Sigmund Freud, you know, his whole thing was that everyone was driven by trying to improve their sexual enjoyment. That was his whole thing. And so Brahmananda very blissfully and maybe even a little proudly explained to Prabhupada how he would always argue with this English literature professor and try and extract out of the whatever they were studying some spiritual basis. And Prabhupada said, no, you're wrong. The professor's right. Everything in the material world is just driven by this desire for sexual enjoyment. Brahmananda was taken aback, but, you know, That's really a very, very powerful force. I mean, in the spiritual world, we see that the highest platform of spiritual ecstasy takes place in Madhurya Ras. And then the highest platform in Madhurya Ras is the relationship that Srimati Radharani has with Krishna. But it's completely different than what what takes place there and what takes place in the material realm. It's as different as night and day. So we initially come to the material world out of a perverted desire to be Krishna, to assume this enjoying position of being the center of so many loving relationships. So we get a very perverted reflection of this in the material world. We get these material bodies, and we can play act as Krishna. We can have our little Srimati Radharani, our little Goloka Vrindavan. But how to actually control that in a Krishna conscious way? Jamunacharya, he describes Yadavadi mama chita krishna padara vinde nava nava rasa damanu ditara tum asit tadavadi vata narismagame smaryamani avati mukha vikara shushtu nishtivanam cha. That since my mind, Jamunacharya says, that since my mind has been engaged in the loving service of the Lord, realizing ever new pleasure in Him, whenever I think of sex pleasure, shushtu, my lips shushtu, they curl in distaste, and I spit at the thought of sex life. So it's based upon a higher taste. Vishaya vinivartante naraharashadehna asavarjam asopyasya param drisva nivartate. So when a devotee, he engages his senses in Krishna's service, he gets a higher taste. And that taste can be so high that one, and as in the case of Jamunacharya, that this lower pleasure that made even the damsels of the heavenly planets unhappy, because it was so low, that the taste in Krishna consciousness can be so high, comparatively speaking, that we spit at the thought of sex enjoyment. That's pretty amazing. So, in this connection, Ambarish Maharaj is used an example of someone who has developed expertise in Krishna conscious sense control. He's referred to as a Matpara devotee, one whose consciousness is always fixed in Krishna consciousness, always fixed on Krishna. Everything that he would do, you know, there's this whole, you know, his feet for walking to the temple, his tongue for glorifying the Lord, tasting Krishna prasadam, everything, his whole life was dedicated. And as a result of that, you know, he was just fixed in his consciousness, a very high taste. And Baladeva Vidyabhushan, in this connection, describes it the only way that one can control his senses is through Krishna consciousness. Not really possible. In contrast to Haridas Thakur, whose Maya Devi herself came to allure him into sexual enjoyment, Vishwamrita Muni, you know, was a great yogi, very powerful yogi. And he was distracted by the tinkling of Menaka's ankle bells. And Ambarish Maharaj, you know, there was a conflict between him and Durvasa Muni, who was a much more accomplished yogi, very very high level of yogic perfection. And you know, he was very abusive to Ambarish Maharaj. But Ambarish Maharaj was just tolerant and just continued as a matpara devotee, fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And ultimately, Durvasa Muni was defeated by the superiority of Ambarish Maharaj's sensual control. He had such a high taste. He was always absorbed in serving Krishna. So, of course, as these examples are there for our benefit, and we should, to the best of our ability, try to emulate them. Not artificially, but according to our nature, we should try to engage our senses in Krishna's service. And lo and behold, when we do that, there's a higher taste that makes these lower pushings possible to control. Okay, there's more to cover here, but the exodus is beginning. Everyone's starting to walk around. I think I'll make one last point, and this is in the same purport as about Tirthapat, that Tirti Kirvanti Tirthani Swena Stana Stena Kada Brita, that wherever a saintly person goes, it becomes a sanctified place, a place of pilgrimage. So, and then there's a really interesting point that Prabhupada makes, that Narottam Das Thakur says, that one should not travel to different places of pilgrimage. But it might put the if everyone took that seriously, the Mayapur tourism department and the guest house department would be out of business in no time. So how can we understand that? The point that Prabhupada seems to be stressing here is that Swantasthena Gadavrita, we have Krishna in our heart, and simply by enthusiastically engaging in Navavidhi Bhakti, you know, the ninefold processes of Krishna consciousness, we don't have to go through the hassle of going in the Jagannath Express all night long and getting, you know, panhandled heavily, you know, in different temples where the pundas are of questionable character. We can actually execute Navavidhi Bhakti anywhere in the universe. And by doing that, actually, those places in the universe become sanctified by the process of the devotees sincerely taking up sadhana bhakti. But I think one thing that stands out in my mind is that there's something very unique about the samadhis. Manirith Swami makes the point in his Samadhis in Vrindavan book that in the Gaudiya Vaishnava line, the samadhis of the previous acharyas are very, very special. The acharyas are very present in those samadhis. And I've noticed after 13 years of chanting in Prabhupada's samadhi here, and then when I go to Vrindavan, I chant in either his room or the samadhi there, that there's a very, very powerful presence of Prabhupada. Also, when I go to Radhadamodar Chan at Rupa Goswami Samadhi, it's unbelievable how much you can experience the presence of Rupa Goswami. And we have an example of Srila Prabhupada that the very next day after he took sannyas, he moved into the Radhadamodar Mandir to get Rupa Goswami Sangha, you know, to prepare himself for his life mission. So what kind of strikes me, it's a little paradoxical, even though this is very much our line in the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, I'm going to bring a local point in, that the Prabhupada's Pushpa Samadhi is a, you know, one of the most beautiful mandiras in the world, actually, and a very powerful tribute to Srila Prabhupada. But by the local devotees, it's almost completely neglected. You know, there's only maybe 4 or 5 devotees that regularly go there, that I'm aware of, that regularly chant japa there and take advantage of the powerful presence of Srila Prabhupada and his pushpa samadhi. So I thought I'd make that point as humbly as possible, and make it known to the devotees that there's a tremendous facility available for you to increase your bhakti at Srila Prabhupada's pushpa samadhi. Okay, I'll stop here, and I'll read the purport that's on the, or the translation that's on the board, and then maybe we can have some questions or comments. The airplanes of the heavenly denizens are bedecked with pearls, gold, and many valuable jewels. The heavenly denizens are compared to clouds in the sky decorated with occasional flashes of electric lightning. So are there any questions, comments, challenges, protests that anyone has? Yes,
Hare Krishna. I was just wondering, maybe you could explain why the material world was created, that sex life is such a natural instinct.
Say it one more time, put it a little closer to you.
My question is, maybe why the material world was made, that sex life was such a natural instinct, like, you know, as soon as children get to puberty, you know, naturally that instinct is there.
Well, it's quite natural that it is like this. You know, I'm not saying that out of just repeating what you're saying, but, you know, we come to the world overwhelmed by two dualities, two primal motivating forces. It's described in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Icha dvesha samutvena dvandva mohena bharata sarvabhutani samhoham sargiyanti parantapa. So these two dualities are icha and dvesha. Okay, icha is this desire to enjoy like Krishna. Okay, and the dvesha part is that is an envy that's originally of Krishna. You know, I'd like to be in the same position as Krishna. So then we get a situation, we get this fake, you know, kind of this surreal material body that's in the image of Krishna. Really, you know, I mean, in the Bible it said man is created in the image of God. So we get this phantasmagoric arrangement so that we can learn our lesson. You know, it's really a school. In this Manasijam Vishahetadira, in this verse that I quoted from Prahlad Maharaj, Manasijam means that we should be learning from the unhappiness that comes from the itching, scratching the itch, so to speak. This Kandutivan Manasijam. Manasijam means we should learn our lesson from what our hellish experience. So, it's, you know, from Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, it's not at all unusual that this is what's taking place. And then when we realize that it actually, you know, this pushing and this desire to enjoy in this material world in any way, shape or form, separate from Krishna, but particularly on the sexual platform, it just creates hellish suffering. You know, and That's what's really good about the Grihastha ashram. You can wake up to all that. You know, it's an ashram which provides the same facility for spiritual advancement that the Brahmacharya ashram, the Vanaprastha ashram, and the Sannyasa ashram provide. Depending upon how one handles it. If one's very strict, then realizations of the illusory nature of sexual enjoyment becomes very, very prominent. It just continually, you know, whacking somebody in the forehead. And, you know, from start to finish, it's like that. You know, I mean, in Shastra, it's not making anything up. It's what actually takes place. And anybody that's been in the Grihastha ashram for a substantial amount of time after the honeymoon period is over, they realize this. You know, and then it becomes an austerity to responsibly execute one's duties in it.
You made the point that these samadhis of the acharyas and the saints are, their presence is very potently there. I thought it's interesting to note that before, when Prabhupada was about to board the Jaladuta, everything was in place, he all ready to go. He came all the way from Calcutta out here to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's Samadhi,
right,
just to receive his blessings.
Yeah.
Where we can imagine Prabhupada, he was never separated from his Guru Maharaj,
right,
but yet he took that journey, which then was not as easy as it is now, to do that before embarking on his journey.
I'll tell you a little story from the annals of ISKCON's Shastric Education. And this is about one of the pioneers in Shastric study that eventually, you know, kind of laid the foundation for Bhakti Shastri implementation, Bhakti Shastri course implementation. And that's Giriraj Swami. I attended his classes in Vrindavan, a nectar devotion, I think three times, a nectar of instruction once. And, you know, he, as many devotees are aware, became quite ill going back maybe 13, 14 years ago. So there was quite a period of time, and he also had visa problems with India. And so there was quite a period of time where I didn't see him, but he was kind of, he had a tremendous influence on my life, you know, taking his courses. And matter of fact, when I started teaching Nectar of Devotion, I got from one of his disciples a transcription of one of his old courses. And what I really liked about his courses was that he would invariably tell some very powerful anecdotes from his experiences with Srila Prabhupada that would really pull out the essence of a particular philosophical point. So I saw him for the first time in 13 years when he came a couple years ago for the Mayapur Yatra. I mean, the Chopadi Yatra here in Mayapur. This is just after Nirguna Prabhu left his body and just before we started our Bhakti Shastri courses this year. And he gave, because he's very close with Radha Swami, he gave the first Bhagavatam class in that temporary structure out here. And he went on for quite a while. It was a very good class. He spoke for about an hour and a half. And afterwards, I went up to him and I just said, Maharaj, it's so good to see you. And we ended up speaking for another hour on top of that. And he told me in that discussion that we had that when he was teaching this Nectar Devotion course in Vrindavan, he would prepare for 4 or 5 hours. And this is the first time it was really done. He went into, you know, he was studying Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu, really going into depth. He was the first one to kind of reveal what was going on with the nectar devotion to the devotees in ISKCON. So he would go in, he would study for 4 or 5 hours before each class, and then the class would be at 4:30 in the Vrindavan Gurukul. This was in the BIHG classroom. And before he would go up to teach, he would go into Prabhupada's samadhi and offer his obeisances to Srila Prabhupada. And he said, Jamastami, it was just unbelievable. Because every time I would offer my obeisances to Prabhupada in his samadhi, immediately some recollection of a pastime that I had with Srila Prabhupada would come to my mind that would perfectly exemplify a philosophical point. And maybe not even just one, it might be several pastimes that he had with Prabhupada that would perfectly exemplify a philosophical point he was going to make in a class. And it was just so empowered. I tell you, when I took that course the first time, I had been a devotee 11 years. And I was regularly, I was a book distributor, so I was trained to always read Prabhupada's books to get the potency to distribute them. You know, you were there. You know how, what the preaching was like in the late 70s. And but when I took that course, I felt I learned more in 1 month. And there were other courses going on too, but particularly that course. I felt like I learned more in 1 month than I had in the previous 11 years as a devotee. You know, about our philosophy. It was just so powerful. So I personally had many experiences, you know, in the potency of Prabhupada's samadhi, both in Vrindavan and here in Mayapur. Particularly here in Mayapur, because is where I spent most of my life. I spent more of my life there than I have any other location really. But, you know, sometimes we speak about the dark night of the soul. I don't know where that came from. I think that's Christian theology. You know, when things are really heavy, you know, and everything that could go wrong seems to be going wrong, you know, in the course of service or in just our lives as devotees. So I go in and I offer, you know, sometimes as soon as I would walk in the door of the samadhi, you know, Prabhupada would turn the ecstasy on, you know, I mean, so it's sustained my spiritual life, and I'm sure that others, if they take advantage of the facility, will find it remarkable. Transformation they'll go through because of the presence of Srila Prabhupada. So profound. It'll help you in ways that you can't imagine. You didn't agree, Prabhu?
In this purport, Prabhupada is mentioning Nirottam Das Thakur, who's claiming there's no need to go to the holy places. If one is, I assume, incredibly fixed up, that wherever the pure devotee is, he can make any place into a holy place like that. And now we're talking about going to samadhis, and almost all the samadhis of the great acharyas are all in holy places. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Charna Sindhu Dekhiya Ganga, that whenever I see the Ganga River, my bliss knows no bound. So I would sometimes be back in the United States of America and I would read, say something like that.
Like what?
No, Charna Sindhu Dekhiya Ganga, whenever I see the Ganga River flowing, my bliss knows no bounds. Krishna Basadi Basadi Boli, wherever Krishna lives, that's where I want to live. On and on and on and on it goes. And so I would always say to myself, what the hell am I doing here? I want to get on a plane and go to these places. So the question is, and if you're going to visit, you're talking about visiting samadhis, you're going to visit samadhis, especially if you're in the Western countries, it usually means the austerity of travel. So, the question I have is this. It seems like, and also if you look at the nectar of devotion, There's a whole comparison at the very end of the nectar instruction. There's a whole comparison of different holy places. How Radha Kund is the topmost holy place. And unfortunately, Radha Kund is situated in Uttar Pradesh, which is part of India. And it could be a long way from where you're living if you happen to be a member of ISKCON. So it seems to me that our sampradaya and our spiritual line is filled with the calling to the holy places. And my question would be, and on top of this, sometimes you meet devotees in the West who say, oh, I don't want to go, forget it, I've been to India, that place is the trash. You know, all I saw was dirt all over the place and beggars and blah, blah, blah. Sometimes you meet devotees who talk like this too as well. So the question is, should we or shouldn't we? Because you get a lot of people saying one thing and now you have this purport saying another. And okay. It seems to me that unless you're very, very strong, and I mean super strong, I mean, I know that my attempts at devotional service in the West and my attempts of devotional service here in India are like night and day. The question is, should we or shouldn't we? It seems like we should, but here the purport says we shouldn't. So maybe some comment.
My understanding of the point that Narottam Das Thakur is making is that, you know, the main business of a sadhaka is to very sincerely and intensely engage in the nine processes of devotional service. That's the main business. Now, you've been going to Vrindavan for many, many years, as have I, and there's a very distinct difference in the environment that's there now as opposed to 30 years ago. You know, it used to be a quaint little holy village with, you know, tungas and bicycle rickshaws. Now there's traffic jams and high-rise condominium projects and, you know, Bollywood music blaring all over the place. So there's, you know, in Navadvip Mahatmya, Bhajino Thakur makes a point that in Kali Yuga, the Maya covering of the holy dams increases, making it more difficult to access the real mercy of the dam, the intended mercy of the dam, because there's all these distractions that are starting to manifest. And whereas in there's one distinct difference, and that's that Navadvip Dham, the Maya covering becomes less and the Shakti increases. So I guess the principle that, as I understand it, Narottam Das Thakur is making, you know, that all the hassles of travel and, you know, dealing with the Maya covering, isn't really our main business. Our main business is to hear and chant and engage in the other aspects of Navaviti Bhakti. So that can be done anywhere. But still in all, there is a facility in the dam. There's an extra facility in the samadhis of the previous acharyas to access Krishna's mercy more so than ever. But it's a question of balance. You know, like there are many Deliwalas that are coming with their tatasumos, AC tatasumos, and you know, just bopping in there and bopping out and going in Prikama in the car, you know, with AC on and the Bollywood music blaring in their, you know, in their stereo system. And, you know, are they really benefiting from that experience? Maybe, on some level. But the main business is to hear and chant and take the sangha of the saintly persons that are taking shelter in the dham. So it's more or less a question of the methodology of accessing the mercy of the dham. That's my feeling that's being addressed by Narottam Das Thakur. Go for the sangha of the advanced devotees that are residing there and engage sincerely in the process that is enhanced, no doubt, by really being in the dham. So these attempts, you know, they get these char dham yatras, you know, where in 2 weeks you can go to all over India on a bus. You know, I mean, it's a big business for the temples in Bangladesh. And that's how they make most of their income. You know, I don't know, maybe I'm... Oops, this is I'm on television, aren't I? I gotta be careful what I say. So anyway, the point is, you know, the process of Uttama Bhakti, residing in the dham is one of the angas of Panchanga Bhakti. And so it is important, but it has to be done properly. And but our main business is serving the lotus feet. Prabhupada left Vrindavan, and he created dhams all over the world. So just staying in the dham, that also requires being there for the right reasons. You know, to selflessly serve the senses of the Supreme Lord. And if we've got that in mind, you know, then there can be tremendous benefit being there. Also can wreak havoc in our spiritual lives if we make offenses there. I don't know, should I give equal time to the television viewers? This is Ashok from New Vrindavan, who's performing severe austerities by staying up really late at night to watch this Bhagavatam class. It's 8.5 hours behind this. So he's about midnight. After a couple has decided that they will not have any more children, how should husband avoid to engage in sex with his partner? Ashok Prabhu, he should become very, very intense about his sadhana practices, engage in as much service as possible, service under the direction of a spiritual master, and try to prioritize any way that he can serving the senses of the Supreme Lord as opposed to serving his own senses. So it's a whole change of lifestyle and consciousness that's required in order to successfully remain celibate. Prabhuji, I can't tell whether you're satisfied by that answer, but maybe you can send a little, you can send a chat message whether that was addressed the issue. Let me know.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you for the wonderful class. I wanted to say thanks to your inspiration and more reading. I did come across one more purport where Prabhupada talks about this particular thing about Narottam Das Thakur. Is that Prabhupada is saying that Narottam Das Thakur says that we shouldn't go to the holy places because there are so many, as you were mentioning in the class, so many pandas and so many...
Cheaters.
Yeah, cheaters. And then our whole shraddha towards devotion, our inspiration will come down by seeing such people.
Can be reckless. Yeah. You go to the highest place, Radhakund, and
you see the wrong people.
It can destroy your spiritual life.
So that's why Prabhupada explains in that purport that Narottam Das Thakur is explaining this. But then he still goes on to say, but still the potency of such holy places is there and we should still visit. He mentions that in that same purport.
Yeah. So it's a two-sided sword, you know. We have to simultaneously do it, but be extremely careful. It's Prabhupada was very strong. There was one devotee that went to live at Radhakund, and he chastised him so heavy, you know, for doing this. He said, come back to me, you know, you can come and work, you can stay with me, you know, because he could understand that there are very few, I've met maybe one devotee, maybe two devotees, this kind of devotees that are Radhakund, I'm sure there are others, so please, that at least I've met them and spoken with them, and I'm convinced that they're on the right, they're there on the right platform. And there are many former ISKCON devotees that are there, and they're chasing the illusory dream of, you know, an express elevator to Prem offered to them by mitacharas, cheaters. And there's heavy things that go on at Radhakund. I spent a lot of time at Govardhan this last year, you know, and you hear about it. You know, it's not something that, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that one shouldn't reside at Radhakund unless he's on the platform of Bhava. So, not a cheap thing. Yeah, any other points before we break? Yes, Prabhu.
On the same subject, the holy places, how about living in this holy place? I know that the Dham special, that Navadvip Mayapur Dham is more for Kali Yuga, but at the same time, is it really a good idea that we should think of residing here permanently?
Okay, can you back up again and just repeat that again, the whole question?
Yeah, you were saying how it's, unless you are on the platform of Bhava, you shouldn't try to live at Radhakunda permanently. Well, how about this holy dham right here, Navadvip?
Well, this is a Darya dham. This is the most merciful dham. Radhakunda is a very special place. As Giranagari Prabhu was describing in the prelude to his question, you know, that this is the highest spiritual place in the spiritual hierarchy. It's higher than Govardhan. Govardhan is higher than Vrindavan. Vrindavan is higher than Mathura. And Mathura is higher than Vaikuntha. So Radhakund is the highest. Now, this is kind of a generally understood principle, is that one first comes to Navadvip Dham for purification. Navadvip Dham is very good for anartha nivritti. And then after one is purified, then one can approach Vrindavan Dham on a bona fide and healthy level and not fall prey to the victimization that can take place there when someone isn't in a purified condition. The Prakriti Sahajiya tendency is very strong in living anti, you know, out of a sense of false prestige, wanting to present oneself as more advanced than he is. You know, to pretend that he's on an advanced level and not be anywhere near, not even halfway through, not even the beginning of anartha nivritti. One shouldn't practice Raghunuga Bhakti until he's at least on the Nishta platform. But we see that some of these unfortunate souls that have gone to Radhakund in the name of practicing Raghunuga Bhakti, their activities are actually offensive because they're not on the proper platform. They're not following maybe even the principles. Four basic regulative principles. So they're wreaking havoc in their spiritual lives and increasing the thickness of the Maya covering of the Dham rather than uncovering it. Like the business of the Mayapur Basis is to reveal the Dham to the rest of the world. And so we have the Samadhi, we have the TOVP project, we have all this extensive propagation of the glories of Navadvip Dham so that people can understand that this will help them in their spiritual lives by coming here and engaging in the nine processes of devotional service and serving Navadvip Dham in some way or another. Okay, so Dhams have different flavors. Like Jagannath Puri also has a different flavor. You know, they have in the Aryan's Shastra, that the pandas in the Jagannath temple use, they only have to be clean from not acceptable activities for, I think, 48 hours before they go on the altar. Something like that, you know. So, I mean, a special mercy for the fallen, you know, that Jagannath gives. Maybe it's a 72-hour period they've got to be clean from illicit sex and meat eating. And then they can directly go on the altar. We wouldn't think of that, you know, here in Mayapur. That's acceptable standard, you know, that they have. It's not necessarily that it's wrong, it's just some kind of a merciful arrangement of Lord Jagannath. So this is also a very merciful arrangement of Lord Chaitanya, that one can come here maybe not having had so much success in sensual control or in executing Navaviti Bhakti, but take it up here and get mercy from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the previous acharyas and be able to become strong devotee. It's a very powerful dham. And so this is the most powerful dham in Kali Yuga. And it's a Darya dham because it can take the most fallen and elevate them. Okay, I got some feedback from Ashok. Oops, wrong one. That was a question. Here's the feedback. Yes, Prabhu, you gave specific pointers that I can try to act upon. Hare Krishna.
I was just going to make the comment that that Gaurakishore Das Babaji lived for a long, 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 long time, 32 years I think it was, in Vrindavan. And then he came back to Mayapur. So
all in the direction of the internal energy of the Lord.
Yeah.
So that he could identify, you know, could help start the resurgence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement.
Yeah, that's the same.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.